This is what you need to know about today. Odessa is getting pounded, and there is nothing that Zelensky can really do about it. Also, just how does the West report attacks on Russia these days? We're going to break this down for you. And speaking of reporting, what do you think of this question from a German reporter?
Can you tell us Europeans, what can we concretely do to help you to kill more Russians? More Russian soldiers, of course.
Oh, yes. More Russian soldiers, of course. That's what I meant. No, I don't think that's what he meant. I think the first thing that came out of his mouth is usually what people mean. The effect is next. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for being there. We're reaching tens of millions of people a week, so let's have another conversation, shall we? So, do you remember yesterday I mentioned to you when we were talking how the Zelensky government is pleading with Mr. Trump for Patriot missiles, and Trump said, sorry, I don't even have enough to spare. He's used them all up against Iran, and that's a big problem for Zelensky right now, especially around Odessa. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to show you what's going on right now around Odessa, because I think this is one of the biggest stories that isn't really capturing the attention of a lot of people around the world. The Russians are literally pounding this area right here, right, that you see right there around Odessa. It's a fascinating part of the story. And there's really hardly anything at all that Ukraine can do about this, right? And you won't hear this story on Fox News. You won't hear it on the BBC. You won't hear it on other Western media outlets. But this is the reality of this situation on the ground right now. The Russians are using a massive combination of several types of weaponry. It's a mix of ballistic, supersonic missiles that are flying into this area, along with massive swarms of attack and decoy drones. And again, let me just say it again, because this is really the important part of the story. Ukraine can't do anything about this right now. They literally have to just take it. So here's the question. What is it that Russia is actually targeting when they hit this area of Odessa right now? They're hitting Ukraine's energy generation infrastructure, right? The way that they make their energy. And they've been doing this for several weeks, undeterred. For example, we understand Russian jet fighters and aviation aircraft are now coming into this area undeterred. The aircraft is dropping bombs on both the port area that you see there, as well as the greater city of Odessa proper. And the biggest problem may be the eventually death knell for, you know, Team Zelensky, is that no ships have been able to leave or enter the port of Odessa. No ships have entered or left the port of Odessa or this area around the southern corridor of the Black Sea to go in and out or in or out of Ukraine since the 22nd of July. That was the last time a ship was able to leave or come into Ukraine through the Black Sea. That means that the Russian military has essentially established what is a blockade. There is a blockade right now, right here in this region. And that's huge. But it's also now starting to look like Odessa could soon be or succumb to a land blockade as well. Because if they completely control the area, they have complete air dominion, and they have a sea blockade going into the area, it makes you wonder what the Russians are really up to here, right? Is it possible that the Russians, this is something we've been talking about on this show for like a year now. Is it possible that the Russians are now thinking about capturing Odessa, right? About going into Odessa, taking it back as Catherine the Great would want, right? Listen to a guy who I think is really smart. I follow him. I follow a lot of people, but I follow this guy because I think he's usually very on point and very nuanced on what's happening with this, you know, war taking place between Ukraine and Russia. His name is Alexander Mercurius. Take a listen.
I have to say that this massive, sustained aerial offensive we've never had from the Russians throughout the period of this war an aerial offensive of this kind conducted against one specific location, this massive aerial offensive, does look to me like it is a preparation for some kind of operation against Odessa. Maybe not tomorrow or in a week's time, but maybe at some point, say later in the winter after the rains, when the weather starts to stabilize again, and you start to get a situation where you can start to contemplate an operation of this kind.
It's a fascinating question. In the past, you've heard when I've talked to Doug McGregor, Scott Ritter, some of those guys have been saying all along, we think down the line something like this could happen. Is it possible Team Putin is finally at the point where they're saying, look, we got to do this. Enough is enough. They've sunk 100 ships in the Black Sea. They claim to have destroyed our Navy. All right, let's take it. Let's go into Odessa. Look, I don't know if this is going to happen. I'm not sure Alexander's saying he knows it's going to happen. But it's starting to become, based on what we're looking at on the ground, a possibility. So if it did happen, how could it happen? Well, most likely, a lot of the military experts are saying it would come from Zaporizhia, or Zaporozhye, pardon me, which is really, an area that the Russians are pretty close to capturing already. It's really just a matter of time, because it's part of what the Russians have done going into the Donbas, right? And if they do that, they would likely work their way down then in terms of using troops to go into Odessa. They would not, experts say, come in through here, at least not with troops. What they also, of course, could do, since they now have complete control of this southern corridor, as we talked about before, is they could probably manifest an amphibious assault into this area as well, using their Navy, and move into Odessa. So, I mean, this is a real possibility, and those are the two most likely scenarios for the Russians eventually do that. You heard Alexander say it could happen sometime maybe in after the cold season, maybe sometime in winter of this year or the end of the year. We'll watch it. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, speaking of the Black Sea, there's something else I got to tell you about. Somebody who's not happy with what Russia's doing, they're looking at the Russians controlling the Black Sea and go, whoa, 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 we don't like this, we don't want this, and we're going to try and stop it. Turkey. So Turkey is literally trying to stop Russia right now from having this control over the Black Sea. Remember, Turkey's right down here. They got a huge coastline. They're like the opposite of Russia in terms of the other side of the Black Sea. And they don't want to see Russia controlling an area which they think is important to them. Look, politically, obviously, there's going to be fallout. There already is. There's already fallout going on from this between Russia and Turkey. But in the end, I think, based on my reading of both men, Mr. Erdogan and Mr. Putin, that they're not going to let this become a military standoff, in case that's kind of what you were thinking. It's not going to go there. Sure. There have been clashes, I know, between Russians and Turkey in the past, Syria, for example, where they were on opposing sides. But Mr. Putin, and vice versa, Mr. Erdogan, they've always found ways to maintain kind of decent relationships. Millions of Russians, for example, vacation in Turkey every year. That's important. The countries exchange hydrocarbon deals. They build power plants together. They have immense trade together. But yes, I mean, just to call it what it is. There's no question right now that the Black Sea is a big deal for the Turks. They don't want to see Russians have control of it. And having the Russians control the entire northern, right, the northern coastline right here of the Black Sea, that's discomforting for them. And it means Russia's once again the established, or it could mean Russia becomes the established major economic power of the Black Sea. Turkey wants to stop that right now. What they've done up to now is called for a ceasefire. They say, we've got to have a ceasefire in the Black Sea. Well, that's not going to happen, right? I mean, a ceasefire would benefit Ukraine, not Russia, because Russia's winning. The losing side always wins when you pause the game, right? I mean, that's the way it works. So Russia is likely not going to give in to any talk of a ceasefire at this point, unless there's terms that are different from what's on the table. So what can Ukraine actually do, right? I mean, if it's losing up here, if it's having a hard time in Zaporozhye, if it can't seem to be able to manifest any kind of defense in Odessa, what is its response? All it can do right now is literally fire missiles to wreak havoc and make lots of noise and get lots of attention by sending drones deep into Russia. I mean deep into Russia, which is what just happened. Look at this headline. Check out this headline. This is in the BBC, by the way. At least 13 people killed in Ukrainian drone strike deep into Russia. That's exactly what Zelensky did yesterday, reaching far into the Tatar region of Russia, which is way, way out west. They hit an oil facility, which can be argued is a quasi-military target. But you know what? Killing 13 civilians who worked in and around the facility, shouldn't that at least be part of the story? Shouldn't that be at least questioned? No? I mean, under normal journalism standards, as I learned them at the University of Minnesota, yes. But there's nothing normal about Western media outlets these days and the way they cover the news. I read through this article this morning when I woke up, and there's not even a mention of civilians being hurt, though 13 people were killed and 70 were hurt. But they didn't use the word civilians. They're just numbers to them, right? In fact, here's what they wrote. It says, Kiev has become increasingly successful at carrying out its long-range strikes on Russia. Increasingly successful, often targeting warehouses or energy infrastructure, with civilian casualties mounting. You see the way they write that? Like they're giving kudos, props to Ukraine for this incredible thing that they're doing, right? This military operation. Is it? Why is that? Why is it that when Russia strikes Ukraine, it's always characterized by, for example, the BBC and others as an attack on civilians? Cruel. But when Ukraine attacks Russian civilians, it's presented as a military operation of sorts, a successful one, right? I wanted to know more about that, so I went to ChatGPT this morning, and I checked myself, right? Because maybe the way I'm seeing it isn't fair. Maybe I'm not being fair, because I tend to have a little bit of a Moscow perspective, right? You see things as from where you are. So after finding several examples of BBC stories that characterize Russian attacks on Ukraine always as an attack on civilians, I went in and I asked to see if the same type of reporting was being used when Ukrainians attacked Russians. And that's the question that I asked ChatGPT, and this is what ChatGPT wrote back to me. It says, so far, I have not found an equivalent BBC headline saying civilians killed in Ukrainian strike on Russia, Ukraine attacks Russian civilians, Ukrainian strike kills Russian civilians. Instead, the BBC's headlines about attacks inside Russia tend to use more qualified or neutral constructions, such as Russia says, officials say, people killed, drone attack, the geographical location rather than the civilians is used as a central frame. So let me explain to you what they're doing here. I mean, I'm a journalist. I write for a living. I capture what they're doing with words and or what they're trying to do, right? In other words, when Ukrainians are killed, they say they were killed. Ukrainians were killed. That's what they write in the story. But when Russians are killed, they say Russia says that Russians were killed, or officials claim that civilians were killed. Also, Ukrainian victims are always personalized in the stories. They're called grocers or teachers or a child in his mother's arms. But dead Russians are referred to as just dead Russians. And when it comes to locations, when it's a Ukraine location, they write about it as if it's a neighborhood or a store. Or I've watched the reports on the BBC. I watched them this morning. Or a place where people had gathered. But when Russia is targeted, they just name the city. Or they call it a geographic location where 13 people were killed. That's it. See, what ChatGPT is describing here is called something you learn about That is a part of journalism, unfortunately. It's called slanting. It's called slanting the news. They've slanted it in a direction because that's what they want you to believe. And that is more often than not what different sites like the BBC, for example, a journalistic outlet or state news, as I would call them, that is what they do. But wait, because it's worse than that. In fact, you could almost argue that generally speaking, European reporters who cover Russia are so biased, sometimes so disgustingly anti-Slavic or Russophobic, that they actually say the quiet part out loud without even noticing what they're saying sometimes. I'll tell you what I'm talking about. Stay with me here. Imagine a British reporter asking President Trump in a news conference, how can we help you kill more Iranians, Mr. President? Imagine a French reporter asking Prime Minister Netanyahu, how can we help you, Mr. Prime Minister, kill more Palestinians? They would never do that, right? They would never say that out loud because they know they're not stupid. Well, guess what? I'm about to play something for you that's going to freak you out. Because it's just the opposite, and it shows the double standard. Listen to what this German reporter actually asks Zelensky in a double news conference. The other guy you're going to see on stage is the president of Serbia. Watch.
Can you tell us Europeans, what can we concretely do to help you to kill more Russians? More Russian soldiers, of course.
No, he's not taking sides now, is he? It's like, what the? What? How can we tell us how? What do we have to do to help you kill more Russians? He's a journalist. I mean, and then he caught himself, of course. But as we say in America, the horse had left the barn. Damn it to hell. For more on this, let's go to Che Bose. He follows this kind of stuff. He has his segment we do weekly. It's called Eyes on Europe. Did you see this thing? What was your reaction when you saw this guy?
I mean, it's remarkable, right, Rick? I mean, considering everything you just talked about bias and slanting the story, of course, as usual, in this little bit, there's always something else in the background, right? And I want to kind of take you through that. Okay. This guy, Michael Martens, okay? You might imagine if this was a sort of a journalism student. You study journalism in college. You understand there's basic rules, etiquette, you know, things you would and you wouldn't say.
Standards.
Okay? Particularly given where this stuff was said, Rick, okay, which is Serbia. This guy, Michael Martens, take a look at this guy, okay? He's a man in his 50s. He's been around the block. He's a seasoned reporter with the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, okay? It's a mouthful, right? The FAZ. Yeah. This is a serious newspaper in Germany, okay? He's dispatched here to Serbia. Now, why is it important that this type of question could be asked in a place like Serbia? You got to understand the history between Russia and Serbia. These are basically brother Slavic nations. Serbia hasn't, for example, sanctioned Russia at all since the beginning of this phase, the conflict in Ukraine. Serbs are traditionally very close to their Russian brothers, and they share history. And where this man asked his question about how we can kill more Russians, how Europeans, the Serbs are Europeans, remember, in front of the Serbian president, who had very controversially invited Mr. Zelensky to Belgrade. There were a lot of protests about this. The fact that he did it in Serbia smells to me like a real provocation. Okay, and why is that the case? If you look at the history of what actually happened in Serbia during the Second World War in Yugoslavia, the Serbs suffered horrific brutality at the hands of Nazi-allied Croats, the Ustaše, they were called. They built camps. These are places that most of our viewers will have never heard of, but our Serbian friends will know about. Jasinovac, a massive extermination camp, the Auschwitz of the Balkans, okay? A horrific place. Up to, you know, a million Serbs died in total. Maybe 400,000 were killed by the Nazi-allied Ustaše. The Germans wiped out whole towns in punitive reprisals because of the partisans that were fighting against the Nazis. And in the end, of course, We had the Soviet military, the Red Army, and the Tito's partisans, this ferocious anti-fascist group who fought and drove the Germans out and defeated them. And very ironically, it was actually soldiers from the 3rd Ukrainian Front of the Red Army who finally entered Belgrade in 1944-45 to rid this place. This is remarkable that this man would come to Serbia, a place which suffered so badly under this type of brutality.
And was liberated by Russians.
Liberated by Russians and allied partisans of the Russians. Absolutely. Absolutely remarkable. Now, Rick, as per usual, there's a little nugget. There's a kicker at the end. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree when it comes to Michael. Mm. Michael Martens, this veteran reporter at a very reputable German newspaper, who haven't really apologized for what he said. No, remarkable. No. 2026, his grandfather, guess what? Grandpa was a Nazi. And he wasn't just any old sort of flag-waving Nazi. He worked for the NSDAP, the Nazi Party. He was a prosecutor, a senior member of the party, a card-carrying fan of Adolf Hitler. Mm. And he actually was responsible for prosecuting Germans who refused to fight in the Nazi army and for actually getting deserters from the very army that was brutalizing Serbia executed. This is a very, very brutal man. And Mr. Martens is now in Serbia suggesting, how can we help, our proxy, Mr. Zelensky, kill more Russians?
And he doubled down. And he doubled down on his explanation. Because obviously people have... Did you see the expression of the Serbian president's face when he watched him ask the question? That alone is incredibly telling. But obviously people have now come to him and they've said, why did you ask the question in that form, like you are a partisan, right? And he said, there's nothing wrong with the fact that I asked a question. Let's be real, he seemed to say. This is a war and people die. So what the hell? I mean, yeah, they're supposed to kill Russians. So I asked him if they should kill Russians. He doesn't give a crap. I mean, he's not apologizing, not in the least.
No. And the funny thing is, if Russia was to start to selectively strike the factories in Germany, in Latvia, Lithuania, if this is a war, and we're saying this is a war, everything's on the table, don't complain then if Russia was to start sinking ships carrying munitions from across the globe into Odessa, as you were talking about. Don't complain if those plants where you're making drones to do the killing of these Russians are eventually struck by those Russians, because God forbid the Russians would do something to defend themselves, Rick, you know?
Yeah.
Remarkable stuff.
But, well, and, you know, for me and for you, because we're both, we toil in this particular craft, right? I'm a journalist and so are you. It's a boring. It goes against all the principles of everything that you're supposed to do. I mean, it would be like if you went on the air tomorrow and say, good evening, today I'm going to tell you how these people should be killed because I want them to die. It's not about what the hell Jay Bowes wants or what Rick Sanchez wants. This guy's literally putting himself in the story or above the story. And that's what really
Rick, you and I both work with RT, okay? We have our arguments with the editorial teams in RT. We're just normal guys working in a big organization, right? We do that.
Yeah.
And that's healthy. That's called a healthy family. Never once have I ever heard any element of our channel or people associated with it egging on or celebrating the killing of anybody, civilians, anybody else. And it's our channel, remember, that's banned in the very country that sends a man to Serbia to celebrate and egg on the mass killing of Russians.
I'll go you one further. Since I have been in Russia reporting and covering the news, not just RT, forget RT, when I go out on the streets and I talk to the common people of Russia, I rarely, if ever, hear people say anything antagonistic about the Ukrainian people or further say that they want to kill Ukrainians. They don't. I don't hear that. I hear it in the United States about Iranians and Muslims and others. I don't hear people in Russia say they want Ukrainians dead. I just don't. Which is kind of fascinating and something that is very different that a lot of people don't understand about Russia. But, you know, maybe sometimes it's all about telling the story the right way. Thanks, dude. Yeah. As usual, what a great conversation. We'll see you next time.
Thanks, Rick.
Jay Bowes. So when we come back, there's literally no way of knowing right now what's going to happen next in Iran. I just read 3 minutes ago that the U.S. has just hit a tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. So maybe things are changing, but we don't know. Is Trump going to attack? Is he going to bomb again after getting pressure from Bibi Netanyahu? Or is the war machine that works him every single day be able to convince him? Or will he just quit at the end and say, we won, and walk away? What does Tehran have to say about all this? Imagine being in their shoes. It's kind of like dealing with a madman, right? We're going to be going live to Tehran when we come back. Do not go away. I'm going to be talking to Ali Akbar Daraini. He is a writer and a researcher for the Iranian Center for Strategic Studies. Stay right there. And we are joined now by Ali Akbar Daraini. He is a writer and a researcher at the Center for Strategic Studies in Tehran. We have an opportunity to talk once again. He is a really, really smart guest when it comes to all things Iran and this particular quagmire that we're talking about right now. I know this because I've interviewed him just recently, as a matter of fact, on my live stream. So we're bringing him back. Why don't we start with this? Breaking news. Let me share with you what I'm reading right now. U.S. forces, this is like within the last 45 minutes, U.S. forces have opened fire on a Panama-flagged ship attempting to breach Iran's blockade. This is per the Washington, the Wall Street Journal, pardon me. They fired on the vessel after it ignored multiple warnings to stop, and a military helicopter then targeted its steering mechanism. What do you make of this? Because we thought things have kind of cooled down for a while, but here's the U.S. now firing into a tanker that's crossing through the Strait of Hormuz. You say what?
Thanks for having me, Rick. Naval blockade against a sovereign state is a declaration of war. The Americans have been giving a false narrative that Iran is the obstacle to the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. So the U.S. is seeking to open the Strait of Hormuz by force. Hmm. No, this is not the case. The Strait of Hormuz is closed simply because of the U.S. naval blockade against Iran and the U.S. illegitimate war of aggression against Iran. That's why the Strait of Hormuz is closed. Iran has been subject to an unconstitutional, illegitimate war of aggression, and Iran closed the Strait of Hormuz as a defensive measure, as a legitimate right to defense, to defend itself. The Americans tried to establish an alternative corridor along the Omani coast to create a reality to actually undermine Iran's position and take away Iran's leverage before any negotiations between them. But the Americans have no choice other than accepting the fact that Iran remains in control of the Strait of Hormuz. Iran-Oman talks are making progress, and that's the only viable option for the return of peace. The Americans have no choice but to accept this reality.
You said a lot there, so I want to break this down so people who are watching us around the world understand. You talked about this new deal that's being put together by Iran and Oman. I think that's obviously very important. And we're also talking about the very foundation of why this war started, which is what you are addressing. The Strait of Hormuz was wide open and anybody can use it until the United States attacked Iran. And then Iran said, okay, since that is in our territorial waters, according to the UN Charter, we are allowed to then manage that waterway. It's perfectly legal for them to do what they're doing. I almost think it was foolish of them not to do it to begin with. But let me ask you specifically about this case, because this action by the United States that I just learned happened 45 minutes ago seems to be, isn't it, correct me if I'm wrong, a direct violation of the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, that I thought my country, the United States, had already agreed to.
Exactly. Under the Memorandum of Understanding, the Americans undertook to completely and permanently end the war on all fronts, including Lebanon. Imposing naval blockade is a very clear violation of the memorandum of understanding.
And in that memorandum in that memorandum of understanding, it said that Iran would control the Strait of Hormuz, and the United States agreed to that, at least for now, and that later on they would work something out. But this is a violation of that, of what they agreed to do, no?
Article 5 of the Memorandum of Understanding says, upon signing this Memorandum of Understanding, the Islamic Republic of Iran will make arrangements for the safe passage of commercial ships through the Strait of Hormuz. Exactly. It says Iran will make arrangements, not the United States, not any other party. Iran makes the arrangements. Simple, full stop.
So there is
no ambiguity.
So here, okay, so if there's not ambiguity, this is where this gets so weird and so perplexing. Why would you agree to something and then defy it? Why would you go back on something that you had agreed? I know what the answer is. Rick, they've done it a million times, but don't go there. Try to put me in your shoes as an Iranian negotiator to help us understand, how do you deal with this kind of thing? When someone says green, and then they come back and they said, no, I said red. And you're going, no, it's right there. You said green. How do you deal with that?
That's why there is absolutely no way to reach a durable peace deal with the United States under Trump. Trump doesn't honor his commitments. He had no intention to implement his obligations. From the first moment he signed the Memorandum of Understanding, he started violating it. So Iran is now confident that there is absolutely no way to reach a durable deal with the United States under Trump. That's why Iran looks at negotiations as continuation of the war. This has profoundly changed Iran's mentality. Every time Iran showed flexibility, it was interpreted as weakness, and the Americans demanded more. Why the Americans are doing this now, while Article 5 says otherwise? Because they had no intention to implement their obligations and wanted to undermine Iran's position before the start of any negotiations, so that Iran is empty-handed or Iran is in a weaker position when they want to start negotiations. Iran could not allow this to happen. From the day God created man until February 28th, the Strait of Hormuz was open.
Yeah.
There was unconditional transit through the Strait of Hormuz, but ships transiting through the Strait carried weapons, equipment for U.S. military bases, and those military bases were used to bomb Iran and kill Iranians. Iran cannot allow its territorial waters to be used to kill Iranians. Never, ever, ever again. That's why Iran's strategy is to de-Americanize the Persian Gulf region and kick out U.S. forces from this region, because U.S. military bases are an existential threat to Iran.
I'll just add this, because I've covered the man for like the last 10 years at least as a reporter in the United States, that what Mr. Trump does, and everyone knows this, in fact, he often brags about it. You were talking about how Iranians view negotiations. Let me tell you how Mr. Trump views negotiations, and this is what he's done as a business person, as a real estate mogul all of his life. He looks at every negotiation as only the beginning of a renegotiation. So everything he signs and everything he agrees to in his mind is only something he knows he's going to change later. And that's how he's been, some would argue, very successful in real estating condominium sales and buildings in New York, et cetera, golf courses, et cetera, et cetera. He's trying to implement that same MO here with your country, and it doesn't seem to be working, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't work with Iran. Netanyahu was able to convince Trump, and the Israeli lobby in the U.S. Were able to convince Trump that he can win He can defeat Iran in 72 hours. Mm-hmm. If they attack Iran militarily, Iran will crumble in 72 hours. And when some questions were put to him that what if Iran closes the Strait of Hormuz, he was told, Iran will have no time to close the Strait of Hormuz because Iran is going to collapse. They don't understand Iran's strategic culture. War is an art. Iran is fighting artistically. There is no balance of power. Iran is a regional power. The United States is a global power. So in terms of military power, the United States is superior. So they assume they can finish off Iran quickly without even resistance. It didn't happen. He's now in the 6 months of his war of aggression against Iran. Why? Because first, he doesn't know Iran's strategic culture. Not giving in to coercion and resisting foreign military aggression is part and parcel of Iran's strategic culture. Employing special defensive tactics is another component of Iran's strategic culture. That's why Iran not only did not lose the war, it has defeated the United States. If you see at the balance of power, Iran should have been the losing side, not the winning side. Iran has won the war because of these characteristics, because of its strategic culture. Iran had to add an economic dimension to the war. Iran was smart enough not to fight a vertical war, engaging in fierce military escalation, but instead it went for a horizontal war, meaning expanding the geography of the war and opening new fronts every day, so stretching out the United States and to make sure that the U.S. finds it difficult to defend. That's why the Americans have failed to achieve their goals. Now the U.S. has two options. One is to escalate further and target Iran's infrastructure, or end the fight, end the war, and leave. They know their allies, their Arab allies, have said, no, don't do that, because if you if you target Iran's infrastructure, Iran will target the entire energy infrastructure in all this region, and the whole region will go back to the 19th century before the discovery of oil.
Yeah. So,
why in the first place? Why Trump attacked Iran? He wants Iran's oil. He wants to plunder Iran's oil. But when he sees that it is not possible, and he will also lose oil from the rest of the region, this will force him to change his calculation. Iran's position is to increase the costs of war for Trump, to convince him that the disadvantages of continuing the war is more than its advantages, so it's better for him to end the war.
This deal you talked about a little while ago, and I promised I would come back to it, so let me come back to it now. What is this arrangement between you and Oman? And for our viewers who maybe don't understand this, there are two countries that basically inhabit equal sides of the opening, or the mouth, as we say, of the Persian Gulf. On one side is Iran, on the other side is Oman. He's talking about these two countries coming together and having a pact to manage and patrol the opening of the Persian Gulf, the Strait of Hormuz. Now, explain that to us.
It's very interesting that Omanis are largely in agreement with Iran, but they are negotiating with Iran on behalf of Arab states in this region and the United States. They are under threat, under intimidation. When we talk to the Omanis, it was an Omani proposal to take service fees from ships passing through the Strait of Hormuz, not the Iranian proposal.
And that's fair. I think that's perfectly fair. If you kind of come through my backyard, and I decide, please, when you come through my backyard, leave a dollar so I can cut the grass, That's perfectly fine. It's called a management fee. It happens everywhere in the world. It's part of business.
That's true. Iran and Oman were very close to a deal until Trump came out threatening Oman. No, they pressured Oman to get closer to the U.S. position and not the Iranian position. The Omanis were to finalize the deal and agree with some modifications to Iran's proposal. But Trump threatened them. You remember Trump threatened Oman to blow up Oman. So they had some reservations. They very clearly telling Iranians that we are under intimidation and threats from the U.S. They want to keep everybody happy. Their policy is no enemies and be friendly to everybody. But at the end of the day, Iran and Oman are making progress in their negotiations. The Omanis have agreed, largely have agreed to the proposal. There is going to be, if finalized, it will be a middle route in the Strait of Hormuz. Inbound ships getting into the Persian Gulf will be controlled by Iran. Outbound ships getting out will be partly controlled by Oman, partly controlled by Iran. They pass through Omani territory. So either Oman had to hand over its control to Iran in its territorial waters, or Iran had another suggestion. You control your side of the Strait of Hormuz. Ships that sail through the Strait of Hormuz along the Omani coast move out, come back to the Iranian waters and get out so that Iran can also oversight or control the outbound traffic as well. It's very clear that what Iran wants is that Iran wants to make sure that it will not be attacked again because of the Strait of Hormuz. It wants to make sure that there is going to be safe passage of ships, not hazardous passage.
Understandable. Understandable. Let me ask you this, because I think this may be the most important question in all of this. Everything that you've said makes so much sense. And I think even Americans or Westerners or people who watch this from afar will look at this and say, you know, Iran is certainly within its rights to protect its sovereignty. It has been attacked. It certainly has a right to manage the Strait of Hormuz. It's part of its territorial waters. The question is, even though all of this makes sense and most people think it's time for this war to end, there's a guy in Tel Aviv who is named Bibi Netanyahu or whatever the heck, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is not going to let this happen. And his amazing influence and power in the United States and over Mr. Trump in particular seems vast and undying. So in the end, he is going to tell Trump, you have to continue this war. And a lot of people think Trump will do exactly as Bibi Netanyahu wants him to do. Are you of that opinion?
To a large extent, yes. What Trump has been doing is exactly what Netanyahu and Mossad have been urging him to do. Netanyahu has been working hard for decades to undermine the Islamic Republic of Iran and drag the United States into a war with Iran. Mm. This is his lifetime project to topple Iran's ruling system. And he failed in his lifetime project. The United States is in a mess. Trump was elected on the promise of ending unending wars in the Middle East, especially ending, not starting any war with Iran. But Trump started the worst war in this region, reneging on his promises. And that's why he's in a mess. He's trying to get out of this quagmire on the verge of November midterm elections. But he has no choice. There is a stalemate. Netanyahu is now, right now, is telling him, look, if you attack Iran again, you will succeed this time. One more push, one more punch, you'll make it. You will get it. And that's why he is in a forever war with Iran.
It seems silly, and I hope that's not the case. I think for the sake of all humanity, certainly for the sake of the Persian people and my people, the American people, this thing needs to end for every reason out there, including economic concerns as well, by the way, for many of the people of the United States who are suffering from this needlessly. Needlessly. I know that for your people, it's more of an existential question. But nonetheless, it's important to bring this thing somehow to an end. Doctor, you are a delight to talk to. Thank you so much for joining us once again and taking us through your version of the things that are happening right now from Tehran. God bless. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure to join you, Rick.
Always. You. Well, that's it for us. You can find us, by the way, on X and on Spotify, and we're on YouTube. And by the way, on Instagram, my gosh, lately we've just blown. Somebody said, hey, we just started an Instagram account. This is about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I think we've got, I don't know, 6, 7, 8,000 followers already. That's, I think, they tell me that's really fast for an Instagram account, but thank you for being there. I mean, at that rate, we'll get to 100,000 cool soon, and then I'll be able to brag, or they'll take me down again. It is what it is. Also, don't forget BitChute. I love BitChute. BitChute's my fave because I guarantee you, if you ever go to BitChute, they will not demonetize you. They will not cancel you. And none of your material, your content will disappear, as has happened to me. Thanks for being with us. Most of all, thanks for letting us into your homes. And we'll be looking for you next time. I'm Rick Sanchez. See you next time.